From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Are Americans becoming culturally illiterate? Writing in the spring 1983 issue of the American Scholar, one recent visitor at the National Humanities Center argues for the desirability of shared canonical knowledge as the basis for literacy in the United States. E.D. Hirsch, Jr., a professor of English at the University of Virginia, says that without shared knowledge as an essential element in educational curricula, American schools are likely to continue producing students who are not fully literate at both mechanical and substantive levels. I asked Professor Hirsch to explain the concept of cultural literacy.
Everybody agrees that literacy is important. And my using the term cultural literacy was by way of dramatizing one of the problems with training in literacy in this country. We know that literacy has declined because scores on the SAT test have declined, the verbal part of the SAT test. And that decline is important because it's primarily a literacy test, a vocabulary test. So what that means is that people are not able to read, which is very important in a democracy, and people are not able to communicate with one another by writing, which is immensely important in a large modern national country. A lot of the sense of decline is anecdotal. I'm not convinced that the decline is serious. What I am very concerned about is the lack of a common core of shared information by people who graduate from our high schools. Because without that shared information, you don't have a culture at all, and certainly not a literate culture where reading and writing can be means of communication. The linguistic system itself is simply not capable of communicating to someone who has no knowledge of the subject matter that's being referred to. No matter how good their vocabulary is in the abstract, they simply will not be able to understand unless they know something about the subject, the topic.
What is it that students need to share, then? What familiarity with what kinds of topics, then?
I think we've paid too much attention to the formal skill-oriented requirements of reading and writing. At a certain elementary level, they're highly significant, but Richard Anderson and other researchers in reading have shown that these mechanical skills are insufficient in training people how to read. What he believes, and I'm sure he's right about this, is it's much more important to teach people about the subjects of their reading, information that's interesting to them about the world and about our culture, as the best way of teaching reading. But quite apart from that, you ask me, well, what should everybody know? That's the heart of the question. If we understand that a culture is shared values and shared information, shared lore, as well as a shared language, mm-hmm. based on that lore, you can't have the language without the lore, then what is it that should be central? What is it that a high school student should know when he or she graduates? I think that if you're asking me my personal opinion, I might be able to sit down and write a lexicon of cultural literacy. But that's not the way to do it. The way to do it is to become conscious that this is something we need to achieve for ourselves and try to work it out in a democratic way that suits our democratic schooling system. As it is, we've simply paid no attention to that problem. And it's generally thought that the fragmentation, or it's thought not generally, but by people who really have studied this problem, the fragmentation of our culture is the chief cause for the decline in literacy. And the chief cause of that fragmentation is the fragmentation of the school curriculum.
Do you mean specialization in the schools? What?
No.
When you say fragmentation.
Take English, a subject I know something about, the school curriculum in that field. Nobody reads any books in common anymore, graduating from high school. There was a time when there was a hidden curriculum. Everybody would read Huckleberry Finn, The Mill on the Floss, Evangeline.
Mm-hmm. Hiawatha.
Sure. That doesn't exist anymore.
Let's pause on that. Why don't students read these things anymore? What happened at what point in American education that kids would come into the schools and not have this shared body of knowledge?
I blame it on two isms.
What are they?
One is I call formalism, which mm-hmm. is the principle that you don't need to teach content, but some formal skill of reading, skill of writing. That's a misguided principle, I think, or it's certainly an overstated principle. And the other ism is pluralism, which is everybody agrees is a good thing. I think it's a good thing, but it's a nice-sounding word that masks a kind of educational and cultural cop-out. Under the banner of pluralism, people have simply neglected content altogether and left it up to any old person to decide what Johnny shall or Jane shall read.
Is this the kind of smorgasbord sort of thing? Kids go to school and...
That's been part of it, but there's no there's no guidance for those who want guidance. The students want to know, what should I know? Mm-hmm. The teachers want to know, what should I teach? But state departments of education, for example, will not provide lists of books or statements about what students should know in various subjects when they graduate from high school. These are singularly lacking because the principle of pluralism, you see, is that is local option, local choice mm-hmm. should be the principle that guides us in these things. And that doesn't matter, you see, the theory goes, because what we're learning is a skill.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the first of your isms. Where did formalism come from? How did it develop?
A lot of people maybe wrongly blame it on John Dewey. Certainly Dewey's following. But the reason, surely, that Dewey caught on in this country an influence on American education, or at least the reason why Dewey was in some cases misinterpreted in the educational system, because I don't think in the end he was a formalist, was that it appealed to a couple of very strong biases in this country. One was the bias to efficiency. After all, it's a very efficient to learn how to... If you learn how to read, that's like learning the grammar of a language, then you can deal with anything that comes along, any later task in school. So schooling was supposed to give you these skills that you could apply later in life. There was that theory, that that it was a very efficient way of spending one's time in school for later use. The other principle that it was based on is that Americans don't want to be dictated to.
Do they need to be dictated to when it comes to things like what they share in school?
They need to decide it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why the subject needs to be aired. My complaint about...
You mean the subject as subject?
That is, the subject of what we should know mm-hmm. should be openly discussed in our society, rather than assume something that has turned out to be false, that some invisible hand will actually produce that shared knowledge without our paying conscious attention to it.
What do race and politics have to do with the exclusion of kinds of things learned in the schools?
This has been one strong reason why the schools have avoided the question of canonical mm-hmm. or general shared cultural knowledge.
You mean by that a kind of list of things to learn?
Yes, either a list of texts or a list of domains of knowledge that mm-hmm. people should know about. The reason that's been avoided is that it's cultural imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
And some black culture or Latin culture will not tolerate or doesn't want to tolerate that kind of cultural imperialism. And of course, they're right. Take the Canadian situation. Where the French tradition it doesn't want to be dictated to by the British tradition in Canada. So I think that strong resistance to cultural imperialism, to dictation from Washington, as it were, federalism, local determination, that's been a very, very strong impulse, and I myself share it. The only trouble is it must have its limitations, because when that pluralistic impulse goes so far that we don't talk to each other, can't communicate with each other, don't speak the same language, then you don't have a culture anymore. You don't have a society anymore, certainly not one that can work.
How are you going to avoid this very diffuse pluralism if everybody has a hand in deciding what should be learned? Are we going to go about this in a form of Republican educational bureaucracy where the parents and the teachers get together and decide, okay, this is more or less what the kids should learn? What will the kids have to say about this?
I don't think, on the whole, the kids should decide the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the parents, the schools are the agents of the parents.
And when you say curriculum, you mean the subjects that the students should learn?
Yes.
Not the methods.
Well, I put it in a larger perspective. What one learns in a modern society in school is what one used to learn in earlier cultures, pre-literate cultures, by word of mouth. That's mm-hmm. what made a culture, and one was introduced, acculturated, is what the anthropologists say, into that society by the adults. One was inducted into adult society by learning those myths and values and traditions that made the society a society, or a culture. In a large, modern, literate society, vast in extent and very diverse, the agency of those traditions is the written word, and plus television now, of course, but also a common language. All these national languages all over Europe were normalized in the 18th century, and the agents who were doing that was the schoolmarm in the little red schoolhouse in this country. It was the agent of national culture that and was understood to be in earlier times, in the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century. For various reasons, that sense of a cultural mission in the subject of English, for instance, and in the high schools generally, got lost. For a number of reasons. I don't need to go into them, but I think that the history of American education has always contained these swings mm-hmm. where you go too far in the direction of pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now in the middle of a reaction against that, because most Americans I talk to feel it's gone too far, including those people who represent what you call minority cultures.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to a conversation with E.D. Hirsch, Jr. of the University of Virginia. In a recent issue of The American Scholar, Professor Hirsch argues for the concept of cultural literacy, the notion that certain forms of shared canonical knowledge are essential for American ideals of a literate society at both mechanical and substantive levels. Professor Hirsch, how did you reach some of your conclusions about these strong opinions that you have about cultural literacy? What kinds of experiences did you have? What did you observe that led you to argue for cultural literacy?
Well, I've said some harsh things about formalism. Mm-hmm. That's my new demon. And of course, I was an out-and-out formalist.
I heard you described as a convert or a returner to the fold.
That's right. I wrote a book on composition in which I was analyzing all the various ways we could learn the skill of writing, the abstract skill of writing, that could be transferred to a number of tasks. And I went into that as far as I could and was even devising ways of testing the skill of writing. And I got some money from the National Endowment for the Humanities to conduct research on how to make our assessments of writing and students' writing better. To my distress, what these experiments showed was that you cannot measure the quality of writing on the basis of readers' comprehension of the pieces of writing, because the way readers, and that was supposedly the non-arbitrary principle for grading quality of writing, how well does it communicate to readers, mm-hmm. which seems to me a sensible principle, and most people accepted that as a good non-arbitrary principle for determining the quality of writing. The trouble was that how well a piece of writing communicates, whether well-written or badly written, turns out to depend on what the reader knows. There is no such thing as a common reader. There is no such thing, particularly in this culture, as the common literate reader in the culture. And these experiments disclosed that. The most discouraging moment came when I conducted these experiments in a community college in Virginia, and the results suggested that Grant and Lee were as unfamiliar to these students as Hegel's metaphysics. And that's when I began to think we've been assuming too much. You can say that they were sufficiently unfamiliar with who Grant and Lee were to make reading about Grant and Lee a chore, as much of a chore as would be some other obscure subject. It wouldn't matter what the vocabulary level was, it was the subject matter that determined how they would read those texts and how well they would recall them, how well they would understand them.
So regardless of how well written something is, it is the larger familiarity with the topic that's at the heart of this problem.
That's right. That is, the quality of writing tends to make a big difference when the readers are familiar with the subject. Sounds paradoxical, but it's explainable. When you're unfamiliar with a subject, doesn't matter how badly it's written, you'll puzzle over it equally in a bad style, in a sort of freshman composition style, as if you're an expert. And that's what our experiments did. We degraded expert writing according to principles to make them look like freshman writing.
Does all of this mean, Professor Hirsch, that the idea of the cultural melting pot is somehow or other coming back to sort of haunt us? All of these fragments that are going in different directions really have nothing coherent at the center?
Well, I think the melting pot is the dominant metaphor, and it's the one we should stick to. It's the stew pot that's turned out to be...
Too many chefs.
Wrong, yes, and too many unassimilated, unmelted bits. That is to say, the melting pot was a genuinely pluralistic idea, but it assumed that we would absorb the best aspects, or the aspects we wanted, of a lot of different heterogeneous cultures.
Let me get you to pause on that a moment. Doesn't that, when you say absorbing the best aspects, that reminds me of a phrase from Matthew Arnold, the whole notion of touchstones. Doesn't that imply the kind of snobbery or elitism that a lot of educators and parents are worried about?
It depends, yes. It certainly involves a kind of cultural imperialism that people are worried about. That is, for one thing, some central agency in Washington that tells us what we should know, a kind of ministry of culture, such as you get in Russia, I suppose, is very dangerous in a lot of ways. The other side of it is, of course, that if you do not have a common culture, you don't have a culture at all. So where between these two extremes are we going to land? And again, I said that there's a general sense in this country that we've gone too far in the pluralistic idea, which I think pluralism is a misnomer. I would say we've gone too far in cultural fragmentation. A pluralistic culture is not necessarily a fragmented culture.
Yeah, that assumes some coherence.
Yeah, well, it assumes shared knowledge.
How are parents and educators reacting to this proposition that you're arguing for here, this idea of cultural literacy, the shared concerns?
The idea of a national curriculum seems to be an idea whose time has come. I've been amazed and gratified by the responses. of course, there are people who still do resist the idea quite vigorously, and I have friends who resist it. But all the letters I've gotten have been enthusiastic, that they were glad that this statement had been made and thought it was timely. So I have the sense that a lot of people are starting to feel as I've started to feel. Mm-hmm. This is a recent feeling of my own. And I'm just another citizen in this respect, and I think that it's something we're all beginning to feel. We can't let it go too far. We'll be shooting at one another.
What would be some of the components that you would include in a national curriculum? What kinds of subjects? And be specific for me. Name some writers or titles or that sort of thing.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because the first thing I would do would not be to name texts and authors and titles. That would be a misconception of what I would mean by canonical or shared knowledge. It wouldn't have to be the same texts. There might be a lot, for the kind of knowledge I mean, there might be a lot of different texts that could get to the same knowledge. So you wouldn't have necessarily a Napoleonic lockstep, Napoleon introduced into France, where every French child would be studying the very same thing on the very same day.
You're talking about the subjects that many titles could sort of revolve around.
Yes, subject matters and domains of knowledge. And I certainly don't believe that they're entirely in the values and myths. That is, my subject is English, and so it's very important that the ideals and stories and myths of a society be preserved. That's where its values come from. One of those values is pluralism. That's why we have this problem. But as an English teacher, there would be a terrific temptation to overemphasize Shakespeare mm-hmm. and Melville, and to underemphasize DNA, for example, which anybody should know about in a literate society. And my use of the example of DNA.
In other words, you're not talking just about the humanities, so-called.
By no means. Yeah. I'm talking about, and I think it's a shame in a sense, that there is, again, that kind of fragmentation too, because there certainly is a domain of the humanities that scientists should know about, and they should be able to communicate with the general public. And there's a domain of science that we all need to know about. Take some examples of the horrors that have been brought forward of scientific illiteracy. One of the great dangers, and Herb Stein brings this out very well, of scientific illiteracy is a kind of antagonism to science. Now, it isn't going to get anybody anywhere to be antagonistic to technology and to science. The problem is how to use technology and science, not wish that it would go away. If you are ignorant of what's going on, if you don't see the romance in those fields, you are going to be ignorantly, know-nothingly antagonistic to science, and a great deal of the literary culture in this country is. As a consequence, you're not going to be able to deal with the modern world. We don't want high school graduates coming out unable to do that, and as parents, none of us would want to say, no, you don't want to bother with science. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why what I'm calling cultural literacy and the curriculum are so closely connected with each other. It's really definable by the question, what do we want our kids to know? We're the adults introducing, acculturating our children into what we hope is a good society, mm-hmm. and we want to try to have some control over what the values are that society and characteristics that it represents.
Let me ask you to elaborate on that, Professor Hirsch. What are the responsibilities of the parents and the educators?
Yeah, I'm awfully glad that you raised that question, because one of the problems is that everybody's been passing the buck. The state boards of higher education have been passing the buck to the local school districts. The local school districts have been passing the buck to the principal. The principal passes the buck to the teacher, because we're a pluralistic society, and the teacher is left holding the bag, though the teacher sometimes asks the students what they want to know or what they would like to study. The parents have been passing the buck in the sense that they feel the schools should be taking care of this job. I don't think that parents realize two things, that schools are performing a parental function. They are delegated the duties of parenthood, where it's the duty of parents to acculturate their children into adult society. That's the nature of nurturing, just as much as feeding an infant is in a human culture. But because of these institutions of the schools, the parents have come to think that it's the school's job to determine what it is that the kids should know.
And they're both looking at each other across this gap and wondering what the other guy is failing to do.
Yes, and assuming that it's the other guy who's taking care of that problem. And mm-hmm. In fact, nobody's taking care of the problem. So what happens, I think, is the parents have a double responsibility of entering this debate of what our culture should be like and what people should know.
Well, what does that mean? Going to PTA meetings and asking kids what they're learning? And
yeah. Mm-hmm. What are they learning in school? Is that what they need to be learning? Mm-hmm. So on.
Are parents today indifferent to education?
I wouldn't say so. That's the other issue. I don't think parents are at all indifferent to the well-being of their children, which is the key to education. I think they seem indifferent because it's assumed that the schools are taking care of this problem. But on the most basic level, it's impossible for the schools to go into the houses of students at night, look over their shoulders, and say, you should be doing your homework. Mm-hmm. Only a parent can do that. And if a parent doesn't say that, there's an appearance of indifference. I think a lot of people are beginning to feel the same sort of worry that I feel. And that national panel that entitled its report, A Nation at Risk, I suppose they meant it that we were a nation at risk economically and technologically because of our bad schooling. That might have been the primary meaning, but certainly we are a nation at risk, culturally speaking, if we don't take care of what is central to any culture, shared values, shared knowledge, shared information. I don't mean that the values have to be accepted, but they have to be known.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a conversation with E.D. Hirsch, Jr. of the University of Virginia. Professor Hirsch is the author of a recent article in the American Scholar dealing with cultural literacy. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about cultural literacy. My guest is a professor from the University of Virginia, E.D. Hirsch, Jr. Professor Hirsch argues for the desirability of what he terms shared canonical knowledge as the basis for literacy in the United States. Without this as an essential element in American education, according to Professor Hirsch, the schools are likely to continue producing many students who are not fully literate. A discussion about cultural literacy this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.